You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I'm Anthony Richter, Associate Director of the Open Society Foundations. Nice to see all of you in New York, and it's a pleasure to be here to moderate today's presentations by the Open Society Fellows, Madawi Rashid and Asif Bayat. So I'm going to, in a moment, introduce the two speakers a little more, but I think that the attendance today is reflective of the broad interest at the Open Society Foundations in and the engagement of our foundations in the events of the past 3 years in the Arab region. Of course, the foundation has been active there, present in the Arab region for closer to 15 years. But the past three in particular have raised hopes very high about the possibility of people power, even if the power of the people has been at times leaderless, unideological, unguided, incessant, disruptive, and in many cases has not produced the types of change that we had originally anticipated. It speaks a lot about the limitations of these kinds of uprisings. We even struggle to find the proper language to express and to describe what is going on. And language itself in the region has been a subject of great contestation as different sides argue for one word or phrase or another to impose over a reality that still refuses to accept easy categorization, explanation by historical analogy, or other types of our intellectual disciplining of it. The setbacks of the past several months in places like Egypt, the stagnant situation in Tunisia, the outright civil war that has taken over in Syria, the situation in of Yemen and Bahrain, many of the countries now, even where huge protests erupted, have been those energies have been, as it were, appropriated in places like Tunisia, for example. Even if the protests were unleashed by young people, the negotiations in a place like Tunisia are all between men in their 70s and 80s. The situation in Yemen has a lot in common with that. And so the very possibility of the institutionalizing a profound change, it's not just a question of language or spin, but actually of the constraints of that are placed by the ancien regime in so many of these countries. It is a backdrop for two fellowships, one which is well underway and one which is yet to begin. And we're very lucky to hear from these fellows, and we're grateful to the fellows program that they've made possible for the scholars such as these to be with us and to pursue their research and enhance our own work. Asif Bayat is a professor of sociology and Middle East studies at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, the author of and editor of 10 books, including Life is Politics, How Ordinary People Changed the Middle East, for me, that was a book which I used as an intellectual guide over the past couple of years. And having worked with Asif in other connections, it's been also great to have him in our midst. Madawi al-Rashid, whose fellowship will begin in January, is a visiting professor at the Middle East Center, the London School of Economics and Political Science. Al-Rashid is the author of several books, including A Most Masculine State, Gender, Politics, and Religion in Saudi Arabia, that's published this year. And she and I have been spending the past hour getting to know one another and make some plans to how we can work closely over the time that she will be a fellow with the Open Society Foundations. With that, Asif, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you, everyone, for having me here again. It's wonderful to be here, based upon my experience of last time, which I thought we had a great discussion, and so I look forward for another round of passionate discussion today. Yes, I'll speak for about 10 to 12 minutes, basically, say how I see the situation. Anthony mentioned already how hope had been risen after the Arab Spring, and now, in my view, there is a lot of cynicism, and for some good reason, there is cynicism. So I don't go into detail why there isn't. The economy is bad, and the prospect for transformation towards democracy, a lot of people think that it is really slim and not really forthcoming. I want to suggest that I think part of the problems that we see in post-Arab Spring is actually part of the problems that the revolutions per se have. It's not just the Arab revolutions, but partly also has to do with the specificities of the Arab revolutions, and I think partly has the specificities of each government within each Arab countries. Just to mention one significant general sort of anomaly or paradox of post-revolution is this anomaly between incredibly high expectations on the part of those people who have made sacrifices, have gone on a strike, and have made a revolution, and on the other hand, disruptive economies and disruptive administrations and so on and so forth immediately in post-revolution. So people have gone on a strike to topple a regime, and then the regime is toppled, and then they can't find jobs. This is a terrible contradiction, right? Which happens in most revolutions. And of course, the result will be basically social protest and disenchantment and some degree of cynicism. And we know that how the economies are working, whether in Egypt, Tunisia, or Libya. For instance, in Libya, actually, the economy has contracted for about 50%. And the growth in Egypt has declined from 5% in 2010 to 1%, right, in 2012. So you see how the situation is. I think partly also this related. So the idea is, of course, that you have to have functioning economies and functioning administration. But this comes actually into another contradiction with the another desire and demand of the revolutionaries, that we should actually do a revolution, meaning that we should purge the institutions, right? So on the one hand, you want to have function administration, ministers and ministries that delivers. On the other hand, you want to purge them, that is, put them aside, the managers and directors and so on and so forth. So that is another problem, and I think this manifested in almost all of these countries, but especially in Libya. The major, I think, conflict that exists right now in Libya is this, this issue of political isolation, that, the militias, a lot of them are Islamists, saying that we should have an incredible purge because we want to have real revolution. On the other, others are saying that, okay, we need managers, we need directors, we need administrators. So this is, I think, inherent in most of the revolution. Often in post-revolutionary times, these kind of contradictions are resolved, in inverted comma, by revolutionary countries going to war. As you know, most of the revolutions that happened in 21st century actually has been coincided with war, external war. And external war in some ways, of course, is terrible, but in other ways is good. Good in the sense that actually creates unity, right, within the country against an external enemy. For instance, this happened in Iran after the revolution of 1979. But of course, in the long run, the war and the implications of the war forces the existing state to be more security conscious and therefore more authoritarian, dictatorial, and so on. So the long run sort of prospect would not be very, very good. In the context of the Arab Spring, this hasn't happened external world. I can talk about it a bit later because I don't have much time. But it has happened in a different way. It's kind of mostly a proxy war. Now, why this I think didn't happen? It partially has to do with the very nature of these revolutions. Now, I've talked about it before, that these revolutions are very different. Arab revolutions are different from the 21st revolutions, which revolutionary movements mobilizes and comes and takes over the state. And so there is a complete overhaul of the state and institutions. In this sense, they are revolutions. In the context of the Arab revolution, especially Egypt, Tunisia, and Yemen, Libya and Tunisia is a sort of somewhat different trajectory for a different reason. In these three, the context of the three countries, that type of revolution didn't happen. In these countries, revolutionary movements emerge and poise to compel the existing institutions, the existing or incumbent states to reform themselves on behalf of the revolution. And of course here, the state might reform themselves or might not. Often they don't, because they have vested interests. So the revolutionaries had incredible popular power on the street, but they didn't have really administrative power. They had incredible hegemony, but they actually did not rule, unlike the revolutions that you had in the 20th century. So this has two very important implications. On the one hand, because a significant and profound change hasn't happened, there is always the danger of successful counter-revolution. Counter-revolution is always there in any revolution, right? But there is a danger that counter-revolution would succeed. And I think we saw it in the case of Egypt. But on the other hand, I think I call it revolutions and not revolution or reform revolution, right? But revolutions have also has something good in them, that by de facto they create some degree of pluralism in society. In other words, unlike the 21st century, whether it's Khomeini or Lenin, when they come over and take over and eliminate the opposition and they start ruling, this could not happen, in the revolutions, because there are plurality of forces already available, especially from the past regimes and so on. And I think this we can see kind of happening in the case of Tunisia. There is some kind of balance of forces there. It's not just Al-Nahda, ruling Nahda, but also other forces. But why Egypt and Tunisia are different, I think it had largely to do with the fact that in Egypt, they're ruling, those people who came to power after the revolution, Islamists, Ahmar al-Muslimin, were Islamists in the sense that they were more exclusivist, right? And really, they didn't deliver what they had somewhat promised, especially in social and economic terms. And so therefore, they created an opposition that came from both counter-revolutions and revolutionaries, right? and so they were toppled. We can talk about it a bit later. Tunisia, however, and that is not, in my view, Islamist. It is post-Islamist, meaning that it is Islamic, religious, but it still wants to play the democratic rules. So they want somewhat secular, non-religious state, but they want, of course, religious society. But they are able to work with other institutions, other forces in society, and something which is also peculiar in Tunisia is the presence of a strong labor movement that somewhat mediates UJJ Tay-Tay, that mediates between the secular and Islamic forces. So I think, therefore, I feel that there is a chance, in a sense, for some kind of electoral democracy in Tunisia. But this electoral democracy, at least for the short run, is going to be illiberal democracy, illiberal electoral democracy. Electoral democracy meaning that, you know, Nahda will take part in the elections, might lose, might win, right? Like in Indonesia, right? It's less kind of, they are not inclined to Islamizing the state, but their vision about an Islamic society might come, and it does come into contradiction with the sort of with certain degree of individual rights and freedoms that other constituencies desire. Yeah, and that is a dilemma that they should really think of how to resolve it. But I think if the electoral democracy continues, there will be a space for them to actually debate on these issues. Finally, post-Islamism is not only illiberal democracy, but even if it's democracy, but it is illiberal, but also economically it is neoliberal. Largely they are for market economy, and that you know, is an issue. Of course, in market economy, some people benefit you know, quite considerably, but others are excluded. For this reason, I think that because of the nature of the polity and the economy, I feel that social movements in the future in these countries will play a very significant part, both on the part of those who are seeking social rights, individual rights, and gender rights, and so on, and also economic rights on the part of the subaltern classes, poor, and so it's going to be pretty volatile, and we should really watch to see how things are going to be resolved. Thank you. Okay. That was very quick.
Thank you, Asif. So I think we turn over the floor now to Madawiyah Rashid. She's going to take us maybe to a slightly geographically different reality in talking about Saudi Arabia.
Yes, thank you. I'm very happy to address you for the first time, and I look forward to working with some of you in the future. It's a great opportunity to share my ideas with you today, and I hope by within 12 months I'll be able to speak with more authority on the topic of my research. So what I'm going to say here is really preliminary observations that I have worked on over the last couple of months. Well, I'm going to take you to the country where it didn't happen. So that is Saudi Arabia. Since the Arab uprising, we had a kind of discourse in the public sphere, in the media, in the West, and also in the Arab world, that there are those very nasty dictatorships associated with republics, and there are those benevolent monarchs and monarchies in the region that are actually immune from this sort of upheaval and protest that the other republics had witnessed. And this is the division between those who say that the republics are the bad ones and the monarchs are the benevolent ones. However, I would like to say that there is really no clear distinction in terms of the practices of power between the republics and the monarchs. And one interesting famous social scientist, Saadeddine Ibrahim, called the republics jumlukiyas, which means a republic and a monarchy. And the, in a way, the practices of power were very similar. They all tried to divide society, put their sons and relatives in places of power and position. They manipulated the public sphere. In a way, to just sum the whole situation and difference between republics and monarchies seems to be hypothetical and doesn't correspond to what was going on the ground. So why it didn't happen in these monarchies? So many explanations were put forward. One of them is to say that these monarchies are oil-based economies and therefore they have more purchasing power. Basically, to put it bluntly, they distribute subsidies in return for loyalty. So they redistribute, the state or the government plays a redistributive role, and they give handouts in return for loyalty. And therefore, citizens tend to accept power without challenging it. There's another argument which says, well, it is the culture of these countries. And here I'm talking about six monarchies in the Gulf region plus two in the Arab world, Jordan and Morocco. Culturally, Arabs are more inclined to accept this kind of government with succession smoothly moving from father to son, etc. Another argument is put in terms of legitimacy, saying that these monarchs have more legitimacy than others in the region. But I would like to say that all these arguments, the economic one, the cultural one, and the legitimacy argument, are very, very inadequate to understand why it didn't happen in these monarchies. First, we have to define what we mean by happening or not happening. And second thing, I would say that in terms of their political practices, the republics and the monarchies shared quite a lot of things. Now, how do we understand the fact that in a country like Saudi Arabia, we did not see the kind of protests or more accurately, the kind of collective action that took place in countries like Egypt, Tunisia, Bahrain, Yemen, and other places? I would say if we look at Saudi Arabia, we really need to see how there is an entrenched fragmentation of the Saudi public. By that I mean there are dividing lines along sectarian issues, and that is the division between Sunni and Shia. Also, there is a gender divide between men and women over many important issues. Also, there is a regional divide in terms of the multiple regions that constitute Saudi Arabia, between the central region, the eastern part, and the western part, and even the southern part of Saudi Arabia. And also, there are ideological divides between people who belong to different ideological trends, from the Islamists to the liberal to the moderates and the radical, etc. So this fragmentation prevented the emergence of what I would call national politics. National politics is a set of demands that people ask, and therefore these demands were not shared by everybody in Saudi Arabia. There are groups that ask for specific issues, but these were not the issues that the others wanted. So this fragmentation is one of the reasons that the Arab uprising did not actually reach Saudi Arabia. A second factor is the role of the Islamists in Saudi Arabia. In Egypt and Tunisia, we take it for granted that this Arab uprising did not actually start by the Islamists, although they joined later on. But they were not the vanguards of revolutionary action at the time from December 2010 onward. Now, if we look at Saudi Arabia, the Islamists themselves had always existed in a kind of negotiation with the state, and sometimes they were part of the state, part of the government apparatus. They were not in the opposition like they were in Egypt or in Tunisia. And therefore, during the Arab uprisings, there were calls calls for demonstrations in Saudi Arabia, but the Islamists resisted them. In fact, they sided with the government against any kind of manifestation of collective action, such as protests, strikes, or demonstrations. And finally, I think the reason why it didn't happen is because there is the perception in Saudi society that the U.S. consistently supports the Saudi regime. But of course, the U.S. also supported Mubarak and supported Tunisian and Yemeni regimes and Bahraini regimes, etc. And it didn't prevent those people from going to the squares and streets. But in Saudi Arabia, there is a perception that the situation is much more complex. In terms of the oil resources, Saudi Arabia is important for not only the US, but for Europe and China and other countries in Asia. And for strategically also it is important in a different way from Egypt used to be important for US policy. Later on, perhaps I could talk about the recent shift in American policy as a result of the U.S.-Iranian diplomacy or diplomatic efforts that may have serious consequences on the internal domestic scene in Saudi Arabia, because it may alter that perception in society that the U.S. is with the regime all the time. So let me, having said that it didn't happen in Saudi Arabia, I would just briefly like to talk about forms of protest that we have seen over the last 3 years. Some of them continuation of the old traditional mobilization. And other forms of protest are very new, and I would say a product of the last 3 years of activity across the Arab world. One of the classical form of protest that had taken place is in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where the Shia minority live. And those communities had always engaged in collective action from the 1950s onward. They had protested in a classical way. They are organized. They have leadership, known leadership. They have youth activists on the ground. And from February 2011, they've been protesting against certain repressive practices of the regime with specific demands. Also, the situation in Bahrain had a great impact on the Shia in Saudi Arabia. Bahrain is only 16 kilometers away from the Shia territory in Saudi Arabia, and therefore there was a kind of religious solidarity with the Shia of Bahrain. But their demands were specific. They wanted the freedom for political prisoners or prisoners of conscience. They wanted economic opportunities. They wanted employment opportunities and also an end to discrimination. But this kind of protest failed to reach the mainstream society. The protests remained isolated, and Saudi started talking about the Republic of Qatif, which is one of the main towns in the eastern province. And as long as the protest was confined to that region, Saudi government and mainstream society were happy that it will not spill over to other areas, simply because of the sectarian divide that I mentioned earlier. So it was a confined protest that actually served the government. As the government tried to describe this protest as an Iranian conspiracy against the security of the Sunni majority countries. And in a way, it absorbed some of the tension in Saudi Arabia because it could be directed against the Shia. So that was one form of protest. It hasn't succeeded in gaining any sort of acceptance across Saudi society. Second type of protest that has been going on for a while, but it increased as a result of the Arab uprising, and that is women issues. Women protested and asked for specific rights. So for example, driving campaigns, employment campaigns, and also women who protested in support of their male relatives who are imprisoned or detained for a long time without trial. So you feel, you see small groups of women and relatives of the detainees assembling in front of the security buildings, the Ministry of Interior, asking for the release of their prisoners. But again, this kind of protest was very limited and confined to specific demands. And also, it failed to reach the rest of Saudi society, simply because I think the government succeeded in depicting, describing the prisoners as terrorists or sympathizers with terrorists. But given the nature of the Saudi judiciary, lack of transparency, it's very difficult to actually know exactly who is a terrorist, who is a convicted terrorist, who is a criminal, and who is a prisoner of conscience. So the third type of protest, and I think this is the most important one, is activism along human rights issues. And it is for the first time in Saudi Arabia we see what I would call a startup civil society that has no existence on the ground, simply because civil society is banned and they are not allowed to form independent human rights organizations. The government co-opted the issue of human rights and set up its own human rights organization, where the director is actually appointed by the government and he serves in the Council of Ministers. Mm-hmm. So here there's a co-optation of civil society and creating something that looks as if it's an independent civil society, but it is actually an arm of the government. And one truly free civil society is this civil society that started in 2009, and it is called the Saudi Association for Civil and Political Rights, known in Arabic as HASM. And it started by activists who had been around for a long time. Some of them had crossed the boundary between being an Islamist or being a liberal. And they formed something that is vigorous, and they wanted to take the cause of these political prisoners in Saudi prisons, and also discuss and publicize torture in prisons. But obviously the government realized that they are a dangerous group, although they had no legal presence. They had a website and they were known figures in the community. Put the founders of the organization on trial, and today they are all serving prison sentences, very long ones, between 10 and 15 years of prison sentence, simply because their list of accusations that the government launched, such as reading dissident literature or having dissident literature, encouraging people to demonstrate, encouraging the relatives of political prisoners to demonstrate. So in a way, this startup civil society is facing a challenge, and it is ended as far as the government is concerned. But its discourse and the information, the language of human rights, the language of civil and political rights had actually permeated the public sphere in Saudi Arabia, although the main founders are in prison. Another type of protest that has taken place are these cyber actors. One might want to call them the hashtag generation. Or the Facebook generation, the YouTube producers. And these are younger activists who are actually engaged with political issues and also social issues. And they are not, some of them are ideologues, but others are real activists or artists or people who happen to be there when the security officer hits a woman, or he can get hold of a YouTube video about torture in prison or the condition of the hospital. And those people are opening up the public sphere to a new kind of information. So there is, if there isn't a Saudi revolution, there is an information revolution. Because this information revolution is undermining public statement, public discourse, and official media. And it is not possible to control it. Those people are making commentaries on what is going on, and they started as bloggers, some of them, but quite a lot of them have just joined as people who are interested in putting their video on YouTube. In a way, they are engaged in a kind of resistance, but this resistance tend to be fragmented. It is not like the youth movement of the 1960s that many sociologists and probably us have studied wrote about. They are critical voices that are fragmented. They may come together in the virtual world, but it has proven very difficult for them to have a platform to come together, to share some common themes and ideas. But I think it's the nature of the tool of communication that makes them very individualistic and very difficult also to come together, simply because new cyber laws in Saudi Arabia were introduced in order to curb the activities of those people who are using Facebook, blogs, and tweet regularly. And they are followed. And in this respect, the government has enhanced its capability to control this new media. And quite a lot of them ended up in prison. And the spectrum is from the liberal to the Islamist. And also people who have talked or produced films, short clips about poverty, they will be put in prison for 2-3 months. Now, the final kind of protest is foreign immigrants, and this has happened, strikes in private companies. People who haven't been paid for 6 months would decide not to work. And again, the YouTube and the tweets are all coming together with those actual and real active workers. They come together to publicize their case. And the recent round of the problem was with the Ethiopian immigrants in Saudi Arabia who were described as illegal, they had reacted and retaliated against the government trying to round them up and deport them. So all this sporadic protest hasn't yet led to what we call contentious collective action. There are signs that this is happening, but Saudi Arabia wanted to preempt all collective action, and in the region it feared what Asif described, a real change or transition toward democracy. And so far, that Saudi Arabia as a regime played three roles in the Arab world since 2011. The first one is a counter-revolutionary force, and it did this first in Bahrain when it moved its troops. So it was an actual positive intervention assisted by military troops to support the monarchy in Bahrain as a model of government, and indirectly in Egypt as a result of subsidies. So far, Saudi Arabia has probably paid around $6 billion in subsidies and help to the Egyptian military and government after July 2013. Then in other countries, it played the role of a containment agent. So they wanted to contain the revolution, for example, in Yemen. Yemen is too complex for a direct military intervention, and therefore through the Gulf Accord, they tried to remove Ali Abdullah Saleh from office while maintaining the regime, and also ensuring that Ali Abdullah Saleh had immunity. But the most ironic sort of role that Saudi Arabia played in the region is to be a revolutionary force on behalf of the Syrian rebels. And this was a strategic choice, not because Saudi Arabia supports democracy or interested in democracy, but it was part of defeating Iran in the Arab world and Hezbollah. The two objectives can be achieved in Syria, and therefore Saudi Arabia put its weight both at the level of diplomacy and in economic terms behind the efforts to topple Bashar al-Assad. This hasn't happened yet, but it is increasing. And I think the recent international scene has made it more complicated for Saudi Arabia to continue to play that role. There is currently a rift between Saudi Arabia and Washington over the rapprochement with Iran, that the Saudis feel the U.S. has failed to respect their wishes, and these were represented in a military strike against Syria and possibly a military strike against Iran. Both of them didn't happen. And as a result, Saudi Arabia has potentially its own ways of destabilizing the situation if the agreement or the coming Geneva conference lead to some kind of easing of tension, only, for example, at a humanitarian level. They had an interest in sabotaging that simply because their main objective of defeating Iran in the Arab world is the main focus. So I think I'm going to conclude now, just very briefly. I may have gone over the time allowed. I think resisting the Arab uprising was a priority for Saudi Arabia. We could discuss why in detail. But Saudi Arabia has succeeded in derailing this Arab uprising, turning it into a sectarian war in some regions, such as in Bahrain and in Syria, and also turning it into a serious secular versus Islamist confrontation in countries like Egypt and in Tunisia. The protest I described in Saudi Arabia does not aim to cause a major political transformation, and perhaps at this stage it is not capable of doing so unless it transforms itself into a national movement. Grievances and multiple voices can create disruption, but for serious political change, I think you need more than that. And so far, the government has the upper hand in dealing with these minor protests, whether they're the immigrants, the women, activists, human rights activists, etc. What we are going to see is a shift. Perhaps it has already happened in U.S. policy towards Iran, which may send a message to Saudis that their regime does no longer enjoy the full support of Washington. And the consequences of this message are still unknown, I think, but they may have serious implication at the Saudi domestic level. And I think I'll stop here.
Thank you. Extremely illuminating, comprehensive take on Saudi Arabia, a country about which we often hear so much. But I wanted maybe to start with a question back to Asif. And Asif, you, in an article in Jadalia, right after the deposing of Mubarak, you kind of coined this a phrase about refolutions, and indeed the whole terminology of what the Arab peoples are living through over the past 3 years has been, as we've observed, a subject of very considerable contestation. And you didn't make it easier by adding a new term to the analytical lexicon, but one of the venues for this terminological contestation, on top of all of the other forms of dispute, has been the events of the past summer in Egypt, and I was wondering you could talk a little bit about what it was that took place in between June 30th and July 3rd. You have written an article talking a little bit about this, and you were one of the people to come down terminologically on one side very early. But it's a subject which is continues to divide the public in Egypt very considerably. So what was it? What happened this summer exactly? How do you think about that?
Yeah. So the piece, the piece that I wrote was actually, I think, a couple of days after July 3rd. And that should be, of course, contextualized. But before that, I was actually in Egypt. I was not there on the 30th. I had left, unfortunately. But before that, I was there, and I could see somewhat how things were really developing. I think what happened in Egypt in summer, to me, was a real manifestation of the revolution. I think it did show the limits of a revolution with F. You know, as I said, revolution meant that revolutionaries, that is those people, groups who had initiated the uprisings, right? Although they had for a couple of years real social power, street power, but they did not rule, right? And of course, the revolutions came to the realization that, in fact, even in the course of the uprising, that this is not enough, that they needed institutions, they needed coercive power. And all revolutionaries have had coercive power. Force has been very important, right? Because there is resistance. So they came to the realization that they needed it, but it was just too late. They didn't have resources, neither a typical sort of 21st century organization with charismatic leadership or coercive power, military and militias and so on. Yeah? So as a consequence, they have constantly and paradoxically have relied on the state institution to change things, on the state which actually they were against. So that is the frustrating contradiction. They were telling me we didn't know what to do. Where else to go? So the take over, in a sense, of for some time, not the take over, the forceful removal of Morsi on the 3rd of July, for a lot of revolutionaries at the time, meant a very uncomfortable, I say it's a midwife, as this is a Marxist thing, it was a midwife for a pregnant Egypt that was ready to give birth to a new social order. But it was an agonizing pain, agonizing labor, because the baby wouldn't come out, right? But the midwife, however, happened to be very dangerous, happened to be the military. And of course, with that midwife, the military midwife, you cannot have I hate to say desirable baby. Of course, these babies are always desirable. But in this metaphor, the outcome will not be, don't quote me on this. But the outcome, of course, is what we see. And there was an understanding that, this is the situation, but they were also conscious that it is very deeply contradictory. But I think that they didn't, in fact, a lot of us did not think that the military would move and create a situation where now we see the rise, comfortable rise, and restoration of counter-revolution. I mean, there is now a real counter-revolution that are rising and is very confident, and they have victimized not just the Islamists, not the Muslim Brothers, but I was telling them that it would actually will subject you to the seculars, the revolutionaries, right? The secular revolutionaries, those people who had initiated it. And we see these they are rounding them up. So this is how I describe, it was part and parcel of the very sort of contradiction of the Egyptian revolution that led to that. I did mention this didn't happen in Tunisia for the difference between the, I think, the ruling parties in post-revolution. I think there's a big difference, although they are both Islamic, Nahda and Akhbar al-Muslimin, and I explained that, the difference. I don't want to repeat it.
And, of course, the military wanted to use the language of legitimacy for its actions and wants to perpetuate the understanding that it's a revolution, that it conducted a popular revolution against the Brotherhood. And that seems to be part of the whole Orwellian topsy-turvy order in which the Egyptian public is still trying to get out of now. But do you see the situation in Egypt? Do you see that there's any way in present conditions that a military dictatorship is possible to endure? In once the genie is out of the bottle, I mean, I think you've also have this a new article which I saw about the 18th Brumaire, which comparing obviously the present counter revolution to the 1851. And do you find in that some hope? Are you trying to suggest that there's some hope that the military's revenge can't survive for long?
Yeah. Yes. You know, initially the military, of course, the military and basically counter-revolution were already, even on the day after the downfall of Mubarak, were thinking of counter-revolution to do something. Obviously, they would do. They were always looking for a chance. I think there was a lot of chance because, as I said, especially the Ministry of Interior and judiciary and so on, almost nothing, not much at least, had really changed. And they were looking for a situation, an opportunity. But they required in post-revolution, you need popular support. And what, you know, post-revolution was the situation where 2012 and 13 and so on, you know, a lot of people were against the military, especially 2011 and 2012 when the SCAF was the ruling. So I think, unfortunately, Akhbar al-Muslimin acted so badly that brought these two strange bedfellows, revolutionaries and counter-revolutionaries, together in a kind of unholy alliance, and led to the presence of millions in the street that military, in fact, use and counter-revolutionary use to justify its takeover as another revolution of 20th, 30th of June. Initially, it seems that the military, unfortunately, had incredible popular support, and I was even afraid of the rise of some kind of fascism. I mean, they use the language of ultranationalism, and Egypt and so on, anti-foreign and very nativist ideas and so forth. And not to mention of the media, which has been horrible in that situation. So there has been that danger. We can talk about it. These are the situations where can lead, in fact, to the rise of that type of fascistic times of stability and the demand for a strong leader. There are all these, instability and uncertainty and so on. You want someone strong, and Sisi comes up with a strong leader. So on. However, I think that if the military is able to address to really clear demands of the revolution itself, then they might actually succeed. Succeed in the sense of their dominance, ruling. But I feel that it is very unlikely. I think the fundamental demands of the revolution, issues of dignity, social justice, freedom, and so on, still are there. Social demands of the poor classes, they are still there. Issues of unemployment, they are still there. And given the economy and the way they are managing so far, you know, they have not been able to address. Now, I feel that there will be some kind of pressure really, on the military. I don't know, what kind of scenario to envisage, but I don't think that they can comfortably rule. I mean, one thing I'm pretty confident about Egypt that, you know, it has, the Egyptian people have shown to have a remarkable ability to be ungovernable. And I think the time can come that the regime would have a hard time to govern. Not that necessarily a democratic system will emerge out of this. That depends on real program, real organization, I think real strategy on the part of the opposition, unified opposition. But I'm saying that a regime would have a hard time to rule comfortably, and out of this conflict, something good might emerge, and something bad.
I want to pose one question to Madawi, and then open it up. I see Joe has a hand, and others will as well. Madawi, I was I'm struck by your conclusion that it almost seems too bad to be true. That the Saudis' defeat of the revolution is absolute. Both abroad and at home. And, you know, the picture one hears of Saudi Arabia, you know, from many places is, first of all, that there's been a certain degree of experimentation at home with certain kinds of top-down reforms. You spoke about a kind of demand-driven reform process, which isn't going anywhere fast, but by the same token, there's a kind of supply-side reform from above, in experimenting with certain things, the appointment of a woman in a high council position as a sign of something, the introduction of more education, single-sex education for women, and then other things happening from below. We were talking about the appearance of this kind of surprising independent arts scene, the YouTube, the content of the YouTube, maybe, I don't know, maybe some of the YouTubers are going to jail, but the number of hits that, you know, there's a whole video industry. There's no, you know, interesting Saudi television to watch. But millions and millions of people are, and I don't know where they can tell where they're viewing them from, but they're viewing the soap operas and TV production on YouTube, groups like Telfaz and, you know, many others. Everything that I hear is that there is kind of surprising things still going on. So is it not the case that these revolutions have had a resonance there, both on the leadership and in the population, and that the kind of the old Saudi Arabia is not capable of continuing without paying heed to the enormous changes that it's spending so much money trying to contain abroad?
Yeah. Well. I take your point that perhaps it's a very dark picture, but in a way, abroad, the Saudis felt euphoric about toppling Morsi, and they thought that they scored a victory there. In Bahrain, it's the same story. So they did succeed. In Yemen, they did succeed. And let's not forget there are enormous financial resources that are cementing, preparing, and enforcing these policies that possibly not many other countries in the region can compete with. So to just give you an example, when the U.S. Said that they will descale or withdraw the military aid to the Egyptian army, Saudi Arabia volunteered to replace that. So who could compete with this money coming? And in a way, that abroad, they did succeed in some projects. But this doesn't mean that they will continue to be successful. As Asif said, that we have, in the last 3 years, witnessed something that perhaps, you know, we might have a setback, we might have a military dictatorship, we might even have a populist, fascist leader, but I think the process is there. And it's very difficult to go back to the old ways of doing things, given the demographic, social, economic factors that are there in Egypt, Tunisia, and other countries. Internally, yes, there is a vibrant participation in social media, as I mentioned, but at the moment, it is resisting certain narratives about politics, about religion, about the role of women in society. They are deconstructing these hegemonic narratives, but we haven't reached the stage where there is a shift from that sort of deconstruction at the level of intellect and at the level of feeling and belonging to the ground. You mentioned that there had been a lot of reforms from the top going down. But if you look at these reforms individually, and I've actually written about them, especially the ones that are related to women's issue in my last book, most of them do not actually threaten the authoritarian rule in Saudi Arabia. In fact, they enhance it in a very bizarre way. These reforms, especially in the domain of gender, they create international legitimacy for the regime, especially at a time when there's a global feminist civil society putting pressure on different regimes in the Middle East and elsewhere, highlighting abuse of women, discrimination against women, etc. So international legitimacy is extremely important. Appointing some women, making women visible, is very important. It's part of this sort of media hype that we talk about the first women, Saudi women who can fly a plane, the first Saudi women scientist. And that is really what we have all discussed in academic circles as a state-orchestrated feminism. And quite a lot of both Islamist, secular dictators have done this before. And it doesn't threaten the foundation of authoritarian rule. In fact, it enhances it, appealing to women. But also in Saudi society, there is now a section of women who are extremely educated with great opportunities, but they feel frustrated. So the Saudi government preempted their mobilization by co-opting this mobilization and by turning this mobilization into its own interest. And the issue of women is very complex because if they go for to drive, the Saudi government always can rely on conservative elements to go and object and campaign against women driving. And they really serve the interest of the regime because the regime could say, well, we don't want to interfere in this social issue because it would our society is conservative. The fact that now there are men supporting women's campaign to drive is beyond the point because you only need a group of religious clerics or activists to go and object to driving, and then you get the message to the world and to society that if we allow them to drive, that is going to be against society's wish. But the fact that those may not represent the majority of Saudis is neither here nor there. So yes, there is quite a lot of activism, protest, but it's still not leading to this collective action. It is fragmented in its demands and its tools.
So I'm canceling that trip to Saudi in March. So we had... I saw Joe Glicksberg and Elizabeth France here. Each had a question. Joe, do you want to go first?
Sure. I really had a comment for you, Asif, when you were talking.
Yeah, sure.
I completely agree about the possibility and the likelihood of an army entrenchment in politics in Egypt. I mean, it's always been the main actor in Egyptian politics, but it seems very interesting. I was just curious to talk to you now. And get your thoughts on what may happen with the new constitution and the struggle over the new constitution. I was thinking of the first constitution. I was just sketching notes for myself, and I was thinking that the Muslim Brotherhood basically was in control of the process and the timing and things, and they excluded to a certain extent the secularists and even the far right wing Islamists, and the army to a certain extent was pushed aside. Although I think that was, and now you have this new constitution produced mainly by elements supporting the army, which is pushing aside. The main goal of the Constitution, I think, is keeping the Brotherhood out. Yet at the same time, there's very liberal things that the secularists and the liberal elements want, which is what you, it's just what you were saying, which is that they want that they're stuck in the middle. Because now, like the military trial of civilians and these things staying in the Constitution, this is making so it's now the army has pushed out the other two. So you almost have like a back to the future situation in which the Constitution is being drafted by a group that excludes the others. Now you have a new group drafting, excluding the others. And I'm wondering if you feel that this battle over the new Constitution that's just been drafted will be an indicator of how things may go in the future as to whether or not the military is going to actually listen to the popular demands more, or whether it's going to kind of fold in on itself and just retrench.
Yeah, I think it's somewhat it does. I think it's not just the military. I hate to say that, but there are within the government there are actually good people.
Yeah.
You know, and I happen to know them. And there is a contradiction between, for instance, the deputy prime minister, right, Ziad Bahadin, and say the Ministry of Interior. There's a big difference between the two, right?
Yeah.
And so, in other words, there are some people within the government and also within the constitutional, this 50 people, and I happen to know some of them. They are actually good people. Good people in the sense that they want to do something good today. So they are using the opportunity. This is very typical scenario. Using the opportunity to do the best of what they can, right?
Even
in terms of rights and so on. So there is a conflictual. There is a conflict. Yeah. And with the new, intransigent policies against people like Ala and his wife and his sister and so on, and others who were the archetype of revolutionaries, who they are in jail now, things are actually, the sentiments are changing. For instance, Tamarrud. Tamarrud initially, Tamarrud, the movement that was supposed to mobilize people against, so on. Initially, of course, it was totally a people thing, right? It was perceived to be totally a popular thing. And then after the takeover of, the forceful removal of Morsi, it turned out that some of the leaders and so on had talks, negotiation, and so forth.
Yeah.
But my argument, first of all, has been that the very idea of Tamarrud is very different from the very organization and the leadership of Tamarrud, right? The very idea that we should go out and demonstrate and by our demonstration force an early election or impeachment of Morsi was very different from some of the leadership of the Tamarrud that we know now, who were talking to the military and possibly agreeing with. I don't know what the military had told them that we are going to, I don't know. But even if this happened, there is a difference, between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And even now, a number of Tamarrud people are disassociating themselves with these recognized, leaders. So all these conflicts, I would say, that it's likely to make some kind of opening.
Do you think this struggle over the new constitution and what's going to be happening, do you think this is where it'll happen, or do you think it may happen post and a little further down the line? I mean, it's going to be a process, I realize, over time. But
I think the struggle, you know, I think the struggle that you had against the constitution that Morsi time, against that would be, against this one, this would be different.
Yeah.
This is would elicit less opposition than that one, yeah?
And it is an improvement, I think. People who believe in open society values, I think it is an improvement, but still got...
That's correct.
Still got, has a ways to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Elizabeth, did you...
I have a question for Madhavi. You know, despite the oil, there are pockets of poverty and unemployment in Saudi Arabia, and I think some of the... You know, Saudi Arabia is not immune from the demands for economic justice that Asif was referring to about other parts of the region. So I wonder what form of mobilization you see addressing issues of economic inequality, how this is playing out in the Saudi context. Labor obviously isn't playing a visible role the way it is elsewhere, but you know, what other forms of contestation might you foresee in the future? Is part of this playing out in the current crackdown on deportations of migrants?
Economically, Saudi Arabia has one of the highest unemployment rates among the youth, amounting to something like 30%, and also even higher among women. But again, remember, Saudi Arabia has also 9 million foreign workers, expats. Not all of them are in unskilled jobs. Some of them are in managerial positions. And this has contributed to fragmenting the workforce, which is extremely interesting. Saudis have always had what they call Saudization program, that is to replace the foreign immigrants with local labor. But in fact, we see that the number of foreign workers has increased and has been increasing steadily over the last decades. And I think it's an interesting policy that the government has in order to fragment the labor forces. And unfortunate for the illegal immigrants, they were rounded and deported. And the rationale was that they will be replaced by Saudis. But it is very uncertain whether they will actually be replaced by Saudis. And this would push Saudis to take their jobs. I think it hasn't happened yet, and we will see. And some schools had been forced to close because the cooks and the cleaners were foreign and they didn't turn up, and even the teachers in some cases, they didn't turn up to school because they thought that the security forces, the police, would come and round them and deport them. So the labor is extremely interesting. And in terms of mobilization, again, because the labor force is segmented, Saudis themselves would started when the Arab uprising gathered momentum in the early months, they started going to employment centers or to the women would turn up at the labor center in order to ask to be employed, and most of them were teachers. And the interesting thing is they had to appropriate sort of loyalty to the king and confront the local bureaucrats who are claimed to be delaying their employment and not following the king's recommendations. And therefore anger is directed against the lower ranking civil servants and not the king. So women had no choice but to actually go along the narrative that the king is a reformist and he's empowering women, very much like what Anthony has mentioned. And therefore the problem is identified as a problem of implementation, of high orders. And therefore anger is directed against these middle-ranking officials, mm-hmm. rather than the political system as a whole and the problems within that.
Go back. Haider.
Thanks for both the fellows. I think this is very exciting. Also, it's great to listen to you again. Listening to you talk about Tamarrud just now and listening to Madawi earlier talk about Hasm made me also think of whether the my guess is that the revolution can sometimes be a fertile ground for certain movements, while other times it can be more of a challenging and defying force for some movements to grow. Yes. And I wasn't sure if you agreed, and if you can think of examples of movements from your experience in Egypt where the revolution helps support these movements grow and move forward, while other types of movements that the revolution proved to be a force that, you know, goes against it and prevents it from growing. And the same, I don't know if Madawi would have an example as well. Yes. And what kind of role does the international movement then plays? When is it time to connect these movements to international movements?
Yes.
And when is it best to just leave them alone? And also being from Iraq, I have to say that it's hard for me to think of any war that helps people unite, whether it's external or internal. But that's just a side comment.
Yeah.
The history proved that wars helped unite. For example, history has proven that war helped unite, because when you take the example of the French Revolution and the arrival to power of Napoleon, then you have all these wars that united the French people until he started losing. So the history is full of...
Yeah, no, I agree. I just think in the context of the Middle East, it was, you know, regardless of the wars that happened in the past 10 years, whether they were internal or external, or a combination of both.
I think the Khomeini and the Iranian regime after the revolution really used the Iran-Iraq war. And I think they not only was helped by it, but I think they actively perpetuated the war. I don't know.
I think societies that perhaps don't have large diversity within the society, mostly religious, sectarian diversity. You might be right.
But there was political division. There was enormous political post-revolution in Iran, political division.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, of course, were not... People benefited, some others, because of the policies of the new regime, they were excluded. So they were beginning to actually... develop new movements against the post-revolutionary regime, and there was a lot of things going on in the provinces, in Kurdistan, in Khuzestan, and also in the streets of Tehran. So, but when the war came, I was there. All this finished, right? Because Saddam was the main enemy. We should defend our country and so on. Well, of course, maybe that also Iranian regime also helps Saddam to, the division Sunni Shia and so on and so forth. So the Iranians were thinking that maybe Shiites will join them, but of course they didn't, right? So, but about your question, I'm trying to think. I have to think. I mean, I don't know now, but all I can say is that revolution open space for the emergence of all kinds of movements, right? And often contradictory, right? And you have, in post-revolution, Middle East, the emergence, of course, Salafis were there, right? But the fact that they became so visible and vocal, I think, was the result of the revolution. But opposite to that, there are now ideologies and trends among the young and the women were totally opposed to the very ethics, to the very ideas that Salafis are advocating. Yeah, it's very contradictory, social space that has been created. So I would say that I think it has contributed enormously for women's power. I really think so. Now, don't ask me how. Don't ask me now. But I do feel that there is a great potential in the future in places like Egypt that women will play a very important part. And that their very public presence, their very existence, and that pretty presence in the public spaces, public spaces and in institutions, and their vocal, both physical and vocal presence will have really, I think, a significant impact, especially against the regimes which are, by and large, their legitimacy based upon partially patriarchy. Yeah, they are questioning that. And that, I think, is a very significant opening, which I think will be, I think, related to what's happening in, you know, Saudi Arabia, too. I'm actually very, well, who am I to be hopeful about Saudi Arabia? But Saudi Arabia, to me, is kind of manifest somewhat similar, say, late 1980s and early 1990s in Iran. You know, pretty repressive, patriarchal religious state, but a lot of things are happening, you know, on the underside in society that tends to unsettle. They are not as such movement, but I say that they are largely non-movements, right? So the individuals are becoming aware of what is happening, but they are not organizationally connected to one another, which it happens, then it creates, you know, of course, movements and further unsettles. I'm sorry, I want to give a chance to...
No. I actually wanted to connect it back to your presentation about Saudi Arabia, because even for the moment, if insist on your gloomy picture, the leadership of Saudi Arabia, or the whole succession, are a series of men in their 80s or late 70s. And among the schisms which you didn't list, which you said were sectarian, men, women, regional, and ideological, you didn't talk about a generational schism, but it's kind of implicit in everything that you say. And also your research project for your fellowship time is looking maybe at some of the unexpected sources of change. So do you, as Asif suggests, maybe ending on some more optimistic or a tentative note about the future in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I mean, I described a lot, six forms of protest that are taking place, but I don't want to go beyond my empirical data.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's wishful thinking and
right. There
is the reality on the ground. A lot of things is happening. A lot of protest, forms of protest that didn't exist before are emerging now. But they have not led to any political change. They may have led to certain kind of reform in certain practices, but the overall system remains intact. There is a problem of succession at the top level, and that actually might be more problematic for observers of Saudi Arabia and allies of Saudi Arabia than what is happening on the ground. But there is just one point that I want to mention in reply to Haider's question. What can global civil society do? I think this is extremely important for people who are not simply looking at these issues from an academic point of view, but people who are on the ground. And I think for groups like Hassim, one of the issues against them from the perspective of the regime was that they contact foreign media, or they talk to global human rights organizations. In a country like Saudi Arabia, this is stifling, and it is very, very difficult. I mean, you know, you could go on one of the television channels that are not owned by Saudi Arabia, and immediately after that, you could be put in prison. Or you could sign a petition asking for as what happened recently, asking for a state of rights and institution, which is one of the famous Hassan petitions, asking for elections at the national level, separation of powers, etc. These are really advanced petitions, basically. But the organizers were immediately put in prison. And as I said earlier, you could put them in prison, but their discourse is being exchanged and talked about and circulating. But what global society could do is, I mean, there are two levels internationally. There's the level of governments and the level of the civil society. And what we have seen so far that when governments intervene, they can make some minor changes to improve the situation. As, for example, what happened in 2008 when one girl who was gang raped in Saudi Arabia and the judge sentenced her to prison. And then I think Hillary Clinton at the time intervened and the girl was pardoned. And so that's one thing that governments outside government could do. But global civil society, I think it would make sense for them to find ways of engaging with this kind of civil society that is stifled in Saudi Arabia, and engage with it in ways that protect the activists themselves, and also this engagement doesn't become counterproductive, because it could actually undermine them, as, for example, the driving campaign, when in June 2011, when there was the first driving campaign after the Arab uprising in Saudi Arabia, the woman she wasn't behind it on her own, Manal Sharif, she was part of a group, but she was sort of the most outspoken, prominent one. She was awarded a prize in Sweden or Norway, I can't remember now. And then that immediately, people started talking about her as an agent of foreign powers or agent of a feminist movement. So there is a balance that is important here. A cooperation in ways that don't undermine these really simple efforts that are just beginning in a country like Saudi Arabia.
Well, maybe I will go after all.
Yeah. You should, I think.
How are we doing, Steve? How are we doing on time? Because I'm confused between the time zones. Okay.
We should wrap up after Asif, perhaps.
Just, I'm dying to ask this question. Madaw, you talked about the possibility of developing movement, especially like street protests and so on in Saudi Arabia. I recently was in Riyadh, and a few months ago, and I felt that I haven't been to other cities, right? At this stage, the area that I was, I thought that the street or the space is not conducive for street politics at all. There are people in the street, right, in the way that you have in Cairo and Tunisia and so on, or in neighborhood Al-Bata, where mostly the foreign immigrants are, and there are streets are full of people. But in other areas, there aren't. Because to have a street politics, you need a particular conducive space for it. Is it a symptomatic of all other cities?
Yeah, I think this is, I think your question should be a subject of another a brown bag meeting, but it's extremely important because space was central in the Arab uprising. This Midan Tahrir, Taghir, Lulua Square, etc. Now, in Saudi Arabia, obviously, we know from the French Revolution how Paris was completely redesigned after the revolution. So there is a connection there. But then, it may be in a different location. And I have seen demonstrations in support of political prisoners in a shopping center. They would go to a shopping center. First, it's cool and it's confined. And people were holding banners that, Fukku al-Ani, which means it's a religious statement, which means you have to free that person who is suffering in prison. Sha'ab yurid tahrir al-sujun, the people want to free the prisons. And they were in the shopping center. So, you're absolutely right. The layout of Saudi cities that are not conducive to politics in the street. Another site is the mosque, which is the old site that we and people in March 2011 there was some kind of demonstration, and it was after Friday prayer, and they arrested one famous person who became very famous. He was nobody, but he posted his video clip on YouTube saying that I want the downfall of the regime. And the following day, on Friday, he went and demonstrated, and he was holding a banner calling for that. And he was immediately picked up, and he's still in prison. And therefore, the mosque Friday, there are similar sites of protest, and it is the mosque, unfortunately, but it has not happened. There had been some clashes in the mosque over Egypt, whereby a Saudi preacher denounced supporting the coup, and then some of the audience attacked him, and there was sort of a contestation there. And therefore, you know, I think people are imaginative. It doesn't have to be a national public square. As I said, a shopping center was good enough for those people demonstrating at the time. Also, the cyber activism is really rampant. Saudi Arabia has like almost 40% of the highest in the Arab world in terms of people who use Twitter. So yes, but it is there, and the protest is there. It has not led to this national politics.
Yet.
Okay. This is regarding, and maybe this is not related completely with the topic, but this is regarding the overtures of Iran that it has recently made with Middle East. I was wondering why Iran at this moment, when they have rapprochement with US, have, you know, adopted a different stance, not as a confrontational, but, you know, like the seeking cooperation with them. How would it impact, and what would be the reactions from the Middle East? What do you think, like, how would they gonna respond to this?
Yes. So Iranians have been pretty vacillating since the Arab uprisings, in the sense that, well, the Iranians first say, we started first, 2009. And they learned from us. And then they, of course, in 2009, nothing particularly happened in Iran, right? They felt it was defeated. And then they became jealous when the, you know, four regimes fell, you know, in the Arab world. Arabs can do, we can't do it, right? So the discourse changed, really. And they said, well, maybe we should actually pursue a revolutionary road, not reform. Reform doesn't work in Iran anymore, right? And then these days, and if you look at the Iranian Persian websites, you realize that, say, you know, actually, good that we didn't go for revolution. It's not working. The end result is not good, and so forth, right? And we pursue, of course, I'm, you know, simplifying, but we pursue a reform path. And, you know, a lot of people were not very happy with the older Ahmadinejad. And they wholeheartedly and voted, in fact, in the last days for Rouhani, right? Now there is some degree of optimism again in the country that this path might be more reasonable and manageable, and in the long run may be beneficial for Iran, both domestically. Reform. Yes. Electoral. Yeah, mobilization and so on. And both domestically and internationally. And there is some degree of that in the country, too.
Well, I guess we're going to have to, there's more questions than time, which is a good sign. But we're going to have to stop here. It's already Friday evening. Steve?
I just want to encourage colleagues to be in touch with us, and we will be happy to act as intermediaries to Madawi and Asif. And by all means, the conversation should be continued in other venues. So this is not the end of anything, but the beginning of a conversation. And thanks to all of you.
Thank our two speakers for talking with us and the fellows program as well. Thank you. Thank you.